Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 438. I hope you're all well. I'm joined today by Lucy Pinder. I really enjoyed this chat. It was an absolute joy. A lot of you will know Lucy from being one of the faces, as such, of the kind of FHM and Nuts era. And I hope a fair few of you we'll also know her from her fantastic podcast, Smashing Sundays, which she hosts with Beth Granville, who will be on Friday. So it's a full Smashing Sundays week ahead of the return of their new series, to give any new listeners a chance to catch up on some of their amazing episodes with Alistair Green, Adam Hess, just loads of really good people. Tom Davis, I think, who was my guest last week. Yeah, that's how we kind of became in contact with each other, because I became a fan of their podcast, and we exchanged some chats back and forth and decided now would be a great time to have both Lucy and Beth on. So we got on both recorded, and I'm kicking it off with this wonderful chat with Lucy. We talk about her podcast, we talk about the Lads Mag era, we talk about her acting, her writing, all the things that have been going on since. One of the things I love about learning since I moved into acting and writing and this kind of thing, how much goes on behind the scenes that you never know about. So there's so many people hustling away, changing their careers and lives completely, and you might not find out about it for a couple of years, or 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, you've done this overnight. So no, there's been loads of work. So I wanted to dig into that with Lucy. Yeah, I'll get onto the chat, but before we do, this is obviously, as ever, this is brought to you by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. You can head over there to get my music, my merch, my books, all the different things I've been doing over the years, and you can support the podcast. You can support it there and at patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. So let's get on with the podcast. This is episode 438 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Lucy Pinder. There we go. Right, I'm here today with Lucy Pinder. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad to be having a chat.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
It's good. How's your day been so far? Have you been doing anything exciting?
No, nothing too exciting. I've been for a walk. Mm-hmm. I've gone and got my nails done. It's all been very like Lady of Leisure vibes.
You see, this is the kind of thing I need to be hearing. Normally, I don't ask people how they're their day's going, but the weather's just started to turn all right, and I think everyone's kind of going, I'm going to leave the house and I'm going to do this or do that.
Yeah, I just went, I do like, there's my kind of my usual walk, like I'm like a 70-year-old woman, but I do like, I'm in a bit of a routine with this nice kind of park walk, and today's been glorious.
I love it.
It's proper spring-like out there, but then everyone's like, oh no, we've got snow coming. We've got a cold snap coming.
That's all right, a bit of variation. I'll live with that for the moment.
Yeah, variety's the spice of life.
Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm in Essex, so I'm similar. I was going to ask, has that been a pandemic thing that's given you your kind of your set walking route? Because I've definitely got my kind of into the habit now. I've lived in this same small town my whole life, but since the pandemic, I'm like, I've got literally on my phone after we finish this, I've got, go and have a walk before it gets dark.
Yeah.
Before it gets too cold and dark.
Because I don't want to forget. This is the thing. This morning I thought, oh, I said, I'm talking to Scroobius Pip at 2. Do I want to walk before or after? I was like, I'll walk before, listen to a few podcasts. I love it. It's so like, I feel like if I don't get a walk in a day, I just feel like my head isn't where it should be. And I think it is a bit of a pandemic thing. Like I've always I grew up in Hampshire in Winchester.
Yeah.
So we've got beautiful, like lovely, like South Downs walks and like, yeah. So I've always done it. But I think making it a daily routine has been such a pandemic thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm in London, but I went back to my parents for a few months, the first lockdown. And I was like, there was literally nothing to do apart from walks and eat, yeah. make cocktails.
Yeah, that's a solid combination. I can't remember who I talked to about this before. I think it was Jimmy Carr, actually, who's a name I probably shouldn't mention at the moment as he's causing all sorts of shit, the silly boy. But he was saying about getting a dog and it being really good for him. And I said, it's a really weird thing that people will get a dog and go, well, this it's a living thing, so it needs to be walked, it needs fresh air, it needs exercise. We rarely think about that about ourselves, which is also perfectly valid. We're a living thing and we need fresh air, exercise, all of these things that you'd, if you had any pet, you'd go, all right, we need to look after this.
Absolutely.
And we don't prioritise it for ourselves enough, so.
But we talked about this actually, because we on Smashing Sundays, the podcast that me and Beth do.
Yes.
We were talking to Tom Davis about how weird people are, because he was saying like this was pre-pandemic, and I think he just got a dog, and he was saying how much he liked walking, and he was saying, I do think it's weird when people are walking without dogs. Yeah. I was kind of agreeing, but now I'm like, after the pandemic, I'm like, everyone should get their steps in.
Yeah.
It's so good for your mind. Like, it's not just like exercise. I mean, a lot of my, I've eaten a lot of Welsh cakes over the weekend, so I needed to get my steps in today, but just mentally, just feel so much clearer for being out in some fresh air.
Yeah. And just, I love it for listening to podcasts, because my podcast listening dropped massively as the pandemic started, because I generally listen when driving or on trains and stuff like that. And where I was at home a lot, I was like, I need to get my listens in. So I chatted to Beth a few days ago, and honestly, I only got round to her to podcast chat right at the end. So I've been adamant I want to get the podcast chat in right at the beginning here.
Yes.
So it's not another. So the podcast then. How long have you been doing it? What it's smashing Sundays with you and Beth Granville, and how did it all come about? What was the reason for it?
So I was quite slow to getting into podcasts.
Yes,
I can't remember what was like the first ones that I was listening to, and I think it was Beth's producer Tom Price. So he produced her Foiled radio series. Yeah. And his production company were producing a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
And it was him. I can't remember if had we all been out. We'd been somewhere. And he was just like, you two are quite, entertaining when you two are just chatting about rubbish. And like, she's, for people that don't know, like my best friend Beth, she's a comedy, an amazing comedy writer. She's so quick.
Yeah.
She's just one of the funniest people on earth to me. And we just, we met relatively like what, about 5 or 6 years ago. We kind of met through a mutual friend and literally like fell in love with each other. Like, we're both very different. We've got very different personalities, but we had a kind of very similar, this kind of parallel, I keep using the word journey a lot, but I guess like journey of things that had happened to us in life. So we became friends. And Tom was like, you two should have a podcast. Like, you are pretty entertaining. And I think it's better now, but I think a couple of years ago, like, it was so male saturated, which is 100%. Great. I mean, you know, my favourite podcasts are made by men generally. But we were like, oh, there is a gap in the market for just a couple of women just talking about anything, like anything and everything. And we were both in very long-term relationships and kind of found ourselves single in our early 30s. Yeah. And there was something about, we were chatting with Beth's writing partner, Dave, about doing the podcast. And we were kind of saying, oh, we just want to like have a bit of a chat. Because when you're single anyway, but especially in your 30s, like it's actually like, it can be really fun and it's really freeing. But those Sundays tend to be like, all of my single friends are like, there's something about Sunday when you're single and you haven't got anything to do, and you know, your other friends are with their partners and their families. And it's a bit like, so we kind of had this idea of, let's like reclaim Sundays as singletons and go, like, it doesn't have to be you sat feeling lonely inside, like find your friendship group, find your joy, find your tribe, that you can kind of look after each other and have fun on Sunday. So it's not, we kind of started it saying, let's get different guests on and ask about their favourite Sunday, their quintessential, like, talk about the quintessential British Sunday. But really, we just want to be a chat. So if someone is feeling a bit lonely or a bit down on a Sunday, like, I literally want people just to listen to the podcast and be like, oh, I feel like I've just sat and had, like with yours, like, this is what I love about your podcast. I just feel like I'm sat listening to a couple of friends chat.
Well, that's what I was going to say. In kind of the boom of podcasting, I think there was an awful lot of companies and production companies and all that who were like, oh, we need to get this celebrity to have this podcast or whatever else. And what works on podcasts is people who are genuinely friends and can just chat. And that's why I fell in love with Smashing Sundays. It felt just completely relaxed, completely comfortable, a loose format. At best, very loose. I remember on, I think it was on the Alistair Green one, I got about halfway through and I was like, hang on, what's this podcast? Have they mentioned Sundays yet? We're just talking about it. It's lovely, it's great, but there's barely any, but that's a good thing. And the more I listened was getting that. I'm a big fan of that, reclaiming days that are meant to be something, but you realise that that's only what you've been told. And I've got kind of a couple of examples. And Sundays, are, as I said, it's a prime example because it is. It's very much either a coupley day or a family day.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're away or out of either of those, it's like, well, what happens? But for years now, New Year's Eve, loads of my mates mock me because they think I hate New Year's Eve. I don't. It's my favourite day of the year, but I stay in on mine, or it's one of my favourites. Day in, I cook myself a really good meal. I choose a film like ages in advance and really I watch a really good film and I really enjoy it. And it was a breakthrough in kind of my late 20s of going, all right, all these overpriced, overcrowded parties that I'm not enjoying being at, but I've been told that that's what New Year's is meant to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that. And another example, a mate of mine who passed away when he was 21, my actual 100% favourite day of the year is his birthday every year, because we've all kind of reclaimed it as a celebration day rather than a sad day. We'll either get on in these times on Zoom and all just chat and have memories, or we'll go around his parents for a barbecue and things like that. And I think it's really important to realise that you're allowed to change what you've been told a day is meant to be, or even what, as blunt as it sounds, what fun is meant to be. If you've been, I grew up in Essex, so fun was always, right, we're going out and we're getting hammered. We're getting absolutely wasted. It's like, it took me years to realise, oh, that's not always fun, and that's not necessarily always what I'm into. So I love the idea of reclaiming things like that.
Do you find that you kind of, I feel like there's something about your 30s, so that thing of this idea of this kind of conforming to what's expected, be it, you know, be miserable on a Monday, be out and posting all over social media on New Year's Eve, or be sad when you're thinking of a friend who's past birthday. And that thing of just, I do think there's something about, I feel like, I mean, oh, I was such a little prick in my 20s. Like, I feel like I lived a very different life then. And I feel like my 30s, I've really kind of found my joy and I found my tribe. And I know what makes me happy. And yes, there's still stuff that, you know, my life is far from perfect. I've not got anything figured out. But I do feel less pressure to kind of that thing of doing the expected or... I don't know, the pressure, that pressure is still there, like, don't get me wrong, but I do think that a lot of people, just kind of not really exploring what makes them happy.
Yeah.
And this idea that, like, especially, like, we get this, me and Beth talk about this a lot as single people, this idea that, like, single people are really selfish because, what you know, everyone else is having to run around after partners or kids, and it's like... We do a lot to, like, make sure that we always make effort to, you know, go and see our friends, or we understand that friends who have got kids or really busier, more stressful lives. You know, I think there's this idea about single people that is so undervalued.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think selfishness as well is a much misunderstood term and word, because a level of selfishness is really important, like for your mental health, like being aware and taking time to go, no, here's what I want to do,
yeah,
rather than what I should feel obliged to do as a friend or as a partner or as whatever else. And I think that's why we have something of a mental health crisis, is we've built so many social responsibilities and duties when we should be going, right, no, is this good for me at the moment? Like, it might be time you need to take a week away from everything, or or have a breather or whatever else. And yeah, I think there's definitely a balance there that needs to be
definitely in. Like our friend, our friend Tom said something about, like, he was like, therapy is for the people around you, like people that actually take, you're doing that so you're a better version of yourself for everyone else. But there is this idea, and I think from especially our parents' generation, like my dad, who's wicked, my dad's great and great company, but I remember having a conversation with him about, he said something about, like, oh, everyone, like, bangs on about mental health and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, why does that bother you? Oh, people should be more stoic. You know, we were this and we were that. And I'm like, and do you not think, what, you think you're better for that, do you? You think because you suffered in silence that our generation have to, it's like, you should want better for the next generation. Yeah. And surely, and he was like, oh, no, I do get it. And yeah, it's such a weird, I think it's a very British thing, that kind of, you know, stiff upper lip.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of idea that it's a weakness to not be all right, and this thing of, like, I was, like, my dad again, he was like, oh, I find it all a bit self-indulgent. I was like, well, you're allowed to think that, but it could save someone's life can be saved by knowing that it's all right to go to therapy, or knowing that it's all right not to be all right all the time and not to live up to standards that society's putting on them. Like, that is actually saving people's lives. So the fact that you're a little bit irritated by it because you think everyone should be... I was like, does that really matter? He was like, no, probably not, actually. Yeah,
it probably like, balances out. That slight annoyance versus actual life saved. It's
like
probably
this,
all right.
This thing of everyone feeling like they have to be so opinionated about everything. And it's like, I said to my dad, does it really... doesn't affect you? Because we're talking about mental health. But yeah. And this is why I love podcasts for as well. I just love that. Like, just being at, like, January, I'm not good with January. The first week of January, I always feel, I feel that slump. And I try and, like we were just saying, I try and rationalise it and go, it is just a week of the year, but we do, you know, that's how we measure time. And I think January is pretty fucking depressing.
Yeah,
and the 100%. Whole first week of January, I was just walking, listening to podcasts and getting myself out of that funk.
Yeah.
And not, you know, not bother it. And that's, if you are feeling a bit shit and you feel like you've kind of bored your friends to tears with it, I love being able to just stick, like, your podcast, or I love Rongan Chatterjee's podcast. Yeah. I've just started listening to Fern Cotton's podcast. And it's just that thing of going, oh, no, everyone's struggling a little bit. You just feel a bit less lonely in those moments when you're feeling a bit down. Or it can bring you out. Like, I listened to, one of your podcast, who was it that was so funny? And it is that thing, it can just really lift your mood, and you feel like you've had a little chat with a mate. So that's hopefully in a very long-winded way of, like, Smashing Sundays is just like mates sat chatting about all sorts of shit.
Exactly that. And you've had some amazing guests on there as well. I kind of want to, I'm curious, as you've said, kind of growing up kind of out in the countryside, that what was your kind of upbringing like, and what kind of kid were you? Like, what did you want to do at school? What were your aims?
When I was little I was really sporty. I was quite a tomboy when I was little. So I loved sport and I loved art, so it wasn't like either or. I used to love drawing and I used to love sprinting. I was good at, like, I've never been good at long distance running, but sprinting, I was really quick. So I was really quick at, like, 100 meters, was great at football because I was quick, and just always, like, was always drawing. Obsessed with drawing. And then I think when I went to secondary school, I think I got that thing that I think we all get as teenagers. I got a bit more self-conscious about everything, I guess. And then, like, you discover boys and you discover, like, friendship groups. And I think I lost a bit of my passion for those things. Like we were just saying, you know, all those things that you do when you're little and you just do it for the joy of it. Like, it's just, it's not,
there's not
make
an end
money.
Goal. It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No kind of plan. I need to make money from this. This needs to be a career choice. And I think that when we get to teenagers, like, it's kind of like it's taught out of us. So I was still like, loved art, had a lovely, like, me and my sister had such a lovely upbringing in Winchester. It's such a lovely, it's a lovely place to grow up. It's not the most exciting place to grow up. It's quite sort of sheltered and comfortable. But, you know, we had like holidays down in Cornwall. I think we had one foreign holiday when I was little. We went to Menorca when my dad's nan died. I think my dad had some money and was like, oh, let's go abroad. We used to go and stay with my auntie, who at the time lived in Cornwall. We just had a really nice upbringing. Couldn't fault it at all.
I think you've touched on something really, something that's one of the reasons people have struggled in the pandemic is you get to a certain age and everything you do suddenly has to be productive in some way. It has to have a reason. And I think a lot of people struggled when we were suddenly in lockdowns and stuff. Obviously, financial struggles and everything aside, but just on the human side of things, people were trying to find ways to be worth something.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you shouldn't have to think that. You should be able to go. Like, I bang on about it a lot because I had a guy called Rutger Bregman on a couple of times, who's an amazing writer. And he speaks a lot about how there was a period that we were trying to work towards, you know, a 4-day working week and prioritising leisure in our lives a lot more. And we went completely in the other direction. I've had huge periods of my life where I get really conscious if I'm not working or not doing anything or not feeling I'm productive.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be the case, right? We should have that thing from childhood massively, where we go, I want to make this because I want to make it, not because I can post it on Instagram and sell it and do this and do that. It's like, no, I want to create because I want to create.
100%. And I really struggle with that, like in my kind of 30s now, which is, and I think that's what's so lovely about, like, my friendship with Beth has really taught me that you can't always... I'm not very good at living in the moment at all. I'm constantly kind of like 20 steps ahead. And that thing of just going, let's just do this, like something like the podcast. Let's just do this for the job. We like doing it. Let's just sit together. Even if we're just doing it for us, let's just do it. It doesn't have to be this thing of like, oh, well, how do we market this? Where do we want to go with this? Yeah. And I think you're right.
What's the end goal?
Yeah. Like that. It's awful because I'm such a like, I just coast a lot, like my whole life. I've never been very ambitious. Like, I was meant to go to uni to do English with media and film. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was going, I guess in my head, I thought, oh, I might be an English teacher. I would like to work in film. So I'll do that degree. And then kind of fell into modelling, thought I would do that for a year, go to uni, pay my student loan off, and ended up like in this career for 10 years that I never planned for.
Well, I was going to ask kind of how you handled that from speaking of quite a nice, secluded, sheltered, in your words, childhood, to suddenly being known all over the country kind of thing, to being one of the main people in the FHM Nuts, all that lads mag era, and kind of it coming out of nowhere, right? It was kind of a
like me and my friend Harriet, we'd taken a gap year because we thought we were really mature and we wanted to work for a year before we went to university. And I remember we had a heat wave in 2003.
Yeah.
And we were both, she was working at a solicitor's firm, I was working at an architecture firm in Winchester. And I think we had like a month left before we were both kind of going off to our kind of respective unis. And she just phoned up one night and was like, oh, it's going to be about 30 degrees tomorrow. Should we just go to the, let's call in sick and just go to the beach? And we were like, yeah, why not? Like, we've got a month left in our jobs. So we just went down to Bournemouth Beach, and this guy, I mean, it's so creepy now when I talk about it. And I remember even when I was modelling and I used to get asked about it, and I was like, I probably shouldn't say this because there are going to be girls out there, like there are going to be some people with some quite nefarious kind of, you know.
You're really lucky it was a genuine thing and a positive thing rather than just a
photographer. And this guy like came up to us, and I'd been like busty from like when I was at school and we used to joke, like, you know, my friends used to joke about it. And but we went, so we were at the beach and this guy kind of approached us. I remember his name. His name was Lee Earle. And he was a photographer for a local, I think like one of the Bournemouth. Was he freelance? He was basically like on the beach. He had his two sisters with him. And he was just like getting pictures of Bournemouth Beach because it was rammed and it was a heat wave. And he kind of approached us and said, oh, you know, it's nothing dodgy, but I can take pictures of you two just like in the, I mean, what a time, what a fucking time. Thank God we don't live in these times. But he was like,
it sounds awful, but it all, you know, ended up legit and progressed things. But yeah, I completely understand that telling this story will be very worrying. Like, don't just accept this.
If
someone comes up to you and says, I'll take some pictures of you. Of you and your mate.
Oh, mate, you were stuck. And I was so anti it because I've never been, like, I think I've always been quite introverted. And I can't remember what, I was like, I'm not doing that. And Harriet was like, oh, go on, do it for a laugh. And I was like, no, absolutely not. And then I did and ended up, he then sold a couple of pictures of me to, like, I think they were in the Sun and the Star. And they both offered me contracts off the back of that. Mm. And I was, at the time, I think the Sun phoned me and said, oh, do you want to come and do Page Three? I was like, absolutely not. I'm not doing that ever. And the Star just phoned up and said, do you want to come and do a lingerie shoot? And it was like, for more money than I'd ever, you know, now I look back and go, oh yeah, we were really badly exploited. But at the time, when you're like 19 and about to go to uni, if someone offers you a few grand, you're like, wow, like this is amazing. And that's just how it, and I kind of hit it. The men's weekly magazines came out in like early 2004 and mm-hmm. I started modeling late 2003. So I just hit this mad time where it was sort of like, it was kind of like a heyday, but it was just, and then I remember kind of thinking, I'll do this for a couple of years. I'll make a bit of money. I'll like buy a house and then I'll go to uni. And it ended up being 10 years. And I remember getting to like approaching 30. And I don't think I ever had a problem. I was always a little bit, what's the word? Like reluctant, you know, it was never, and that's not like judging anyone whose dream it was to kind of, you know, be a glamour model or a Page Three, but it was never something that was even on my radar. So when I was doing it, I didn't know anything about that world. And I think because at the time that I did it, like I wasn't on social media when I was modelling, thank God, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't have wanted to know what was, you know, being said. But I was always a bit like, oh, I just do it for another year and then I'll stop. And then you just get into it. And the actual job was fine. Like people always say, oh, it must have been, you know, you must have met some really dodgy characters. But at the time that I did it, you know, all of the photographer, there were, of course, there was some dodgy people around, but everyone we worked with the magazines, it was so professional. And these were like, you know, but I think I didn't realise at the time, I would justify it in my head and always go, oh, I'll stop in a year, I'll do something with it. But I didn't have anyone around me. Like, I remember being like in my mid 20s and thinking, I really don't want to do this anymore. I want to do something else. I want to either go back to uni. I've toyed with like a psychology degree for my whole adult life. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't have the support really from like at the time kind of partner or anyone to kind of go, do something that makes you actually something that you're proud of. So I just kind of kept doing it and I can't bellyache about it because I did some amazing things and I don't regret it because I wouldn't be where I am now. But when people go, oh, do you regret it? And I'm like, I don't regret, like, it doesn't, this sounds weird, but it doesn't bother me that, like, anyone can Google naked pictures of me tomorrow. But as I've got older, I've started to understand the damage of just working for some of those publications. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that, I mean, I didn't work for The Sun. I always used to work for The Star. But you think back to like, they literally used to have, you know, they'd have a girl on Page Three of The Sun with a speech bubble saying, you know, Sam, 21 from Essex, thinks that all those refugees in dinghies should go the hell back home. So when people go, oh, have you got a problem with it? And I'm like, I do, because I was part of something that the messaging, I think, was really damaging, like a bigger thing that I didn't think of at the time.
It's a really interesting and nuanced time. I remember around then I was approached by the band Page Three campaign to support that. And I thought about it a lot. And I knew a few different people who were in glamour in numerous different things. And I kind of said, look, I'm not comfortable getting behind it. Because number one, it seems backwards to tell women what they can or can't do as a job. I knew women who were perfectly happy to be doing that and earning a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it felt weird as a male to turn around and go, you shouldn't do that. Yeah. That's not acceptable. And the kind of the longer response I gave was, I think there's far more damage in the rest of the pages of The Sun, whether it be the celebrity gossip where they're just tearing people down or the fashion bits where at that era of the supermodel, there was really unhealthy body image stuff being promoted and pushed. And again, and then just add at the end all the racism. But in general, and I kind of went back with that. And the person who approached me at the time, again, I don't know who they were, if they're at the front of it or just at the side, kind of turned around and said, look, I agree with all of that, but ban Page Three is easier to push. It's an easier slogan or whatever else. I was like, well, cool, I'm not on board then. Because it's, again, the issues are far greater than that. But as I said, it is such a weird and nuanced time because there must have been so much exploitation, misogyny, men making loads of money off of young women, but also there were women making a lot of money, as you've said, not really meeting any horrible people.
Yeah.
Your reservations seem to come from just your own preference rather than any kind of, you know, I'm being pushed into this or pushed into that. It's kind of, as you've said, if you weren't that outgoing or confident in the first place, you might be like, well, this is fun, but I don't want to keep doing it because it's not natural to me, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, and I think just that the actual kind of day-to-day of it was literally just, you know, go up to London, do a photo shoot, see all the lovely people and the other girls and have a really nice day and then go home. So I was very... It was always, I found it like a really, not that it was really hard, but that thing of my life experience was just very normal. You know, when I was at home in Winchester, I was like a Stepford wife in my house.
The key part of that story is, and then go home. Because that's where that industry and era got dark, was when there were all sorts of parties or events or whatever and people,
But I say, like, the flip side of what you were just saying, of you being asked to kind of vocalise ban Page Three, I was constantly asked to go on to defend it. So I think I did one years ago. I went on, like, Richard and Judy to speak about it. And I kind of, you know, I was so young and naive, but I was kind of going, oh, well, I think women's magazines are more damaging and, you know, not really understanding that it's all part of the same thing. But I remember kind of throughout my career constantly being asked to do those things, and I was like, I don't want to, because I see the issues with it. Just because I'm doing it doesn't mean I'm a massive advocate for it. And I think as I've got older now, it's hard to weigh that up, to go, oh, but you still did it though, didn't you, even though you had the issues with
it's the early days of what's been heightened now, if it's always us and them, our team and their team,
polarized,
rather than nuance.
No grey area.
If you were asked to come on to give your honest opinion and say, no, I do this, yeah, there's some things I'm not sure about, then that wouldn't be what they're after. They want you to come on and go, no, it's perfectly fine, it's this, it's that, rather than have an honest debate on the situation.
Absolutely. And it felt so like that at the time. But yeah, it's such a weird one with that, because I can't regret it, because I like where I'm at now. But when people say, oh, would you do it again? I'm like, absolutely not. But I wouldn't do it again with the hindsight of what I know now. And I wouldn't know that back then. So it's kind of, you know.
It's a catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's like, it's not like I'm, you know, deeply ashamed, but I'm not proud. Like, I'm just sort of like, that was my job and I made those decisions at the time and I can't undo that.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a very different person now, because me and Beth joke a lot. We're like, oh, shall I just do an OnlyFans? Because I've got my eye on a Hackney townhouse. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, and I thought about it for a while. I thought, I can't. I thought, I'm too long in the tooth to be doing that. But a lot of the girls I know are, and they're earning far more money than we ever earn through the
magazines. What's interesting now with OnlyFans in this era, where the power is put back on the women creating the content rather than some big editors or whatever else. So it is a far more honest industry in many ways. Again, still 100% there's going to be pitfalls, there's going to be highs and lows and dangerous parts and all this. But in general, I think it's your OnlyFans and your Fanslies and whatever else, I think, are really good because they give people that autonomy to go, here's what I'm comfortable with. Again, there's no one pressuring or no boss pressuring you, I guess. There could always be fan base or whatever else, but
It feels to me, I mean, a couple of the girls I know that have got it that just feel like they're just more in control of it.
Yeah.
And it is that, it's not even that, and a lot of, I don't know, but like my friend Rian Sugden, we've talked about this, that a lot of that sort of embarrassment and regret over it wasn't even the images or the pictures. It was the stuff that went along with it. It was the having, you know, really kind of sordid, you know, misquoting or people making up interviews with you saying stuff and you just kind of going, oh, well, I have to just deal with that because that's what I am. And I think that was more damaging than possibly just the visual of going, you know, when you say, oh, have you got a real, is it really horrible that people just see you as like an object or a picture? And I was like, it's so fucked up. But I was like, I'm happier with that. If people are just going, oh, that's just a pretty picture or whatever, doing whatever with it, I was like, I can kind of get my head around that more than people thinking or assuming that they know me because of that.
Yeah.
So it's a weird one.
It's weirdly, it's one of the things I like about the podcast. One of the reasons I started my podcast is when I was doing music and spoken word, a lot of my stuff was quite highbrow. And I started to get really paranoid that people think I'm far more intelligent than I am. It's a weird thing to worry about. But I wanted to do the podcast so that people can kind of love me or hate me, but actually know me, if you know what I mean, rather than this version of that they've heard 12 songs. And that's such a small part of my thought process. And I think it's similar on the podcast because of the way those magazines were represented and maybe some of the way some of the interviews were done, there's an unfair stereotype of the lads mag era women. And you absolutely smash that stereotype because you're well spoken, you're articulate, you've got opinions and open for discussion and debate and all these other things, rather than, as you say, what might have been represented as you in a little air quote or a bubble or whatever else. And I think podcasts and that are fascinating for that because...
Oh, I love it.
Some people will have come across Smashing Sundays from going, oh, Lucy Pinder's doing a podcast. I liked her in FHM or whatever else. And then go, oh, right, this is a human. This is a person with views and opinions and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's what you said. It's like, I don't, if people are going to hate, if someone's going to hate you, like, hate me for who I am. Then.
I'd rather they hate me for hours of podcasting. And there's loads of reasons to hate me across my podcasts. I've provided plenty. One of the things that really interested me there, again, comparing to my career, which seems really odd because we've had very different careers.
No, but it is. It's like there are some real parallels.
People often talk to me about my career going from music into podcasting and into acting and all these other things and think it looks like I've planned it out really well. So hearing you say how you've kind of never had a plan and stumbled along is interesting because, like, I'm sure you're aware of this, but some of the people I know who were in that world back then or now, the Lucy Pinder kind of method or approach was literally a discussed thing as kind of a business method. Because as you said, there was, I'm now saying, because of your own preference or discomfort, you held off a long time for going, was it topless? I can't remember what the...
I didn't. I think just because the way I got into it and it was so alien to me, I was like, when The Sun first phoned up that first couple of weeks...
Yeah.
And said, we want you to come and do page three. I was like, I would never do page three. Imagine getting your boobs out in a national newspaper. So I was like, no, thanks. And then I think I then was in that world And I think I didn't do topless for the first like 5 years of my modelling career.
And that was it. Again, to be clear, it's talked about wonderfully positively because it feels like such a good business approach. I didn't want it to imply our people talk about, but no, yeah, because it feels like it felt like from the outside a really strong business approach because you spent a long time building up the value of a certain thing. So when you did finally decide to do a topless shoot, the fee, I'd imagine, would be far higher than you would have got from the Sun when they're approaching you to do page three and things like that. So it's interesting to hear that it wasn't quite as planned out as it sounds, because from the outside, it's like, man, that's been played perfectly as a career.
Not even slightly planned out. I think because I fell into it and I always, you know, every year the Daily Star would then do a Find the New Lucy competition. So every year I was like, oh, they'll find another girl and they'll stop offering me this money to do monthly shoots with them. So it's hindsight, isn't it? If someone had said to me, you're going to have this career in glamour modelling and these opportunities in the next 10 years, I would have done things very differently. I don't think I ever would have done page three, but because it wasn't, all it was year to year going, okay, I'm still employed, I'm getting another contract renewed.
Yeah.
And there was always more and more pressure from the Daily Star, from IPC, from Nuts Magazine to go, oh, you know, we want to offer you this for it. And I turned down, you know, for 5 years, I was like, I don't really want to do it. And then 5 years in, and just having, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world that my boobs were all over the internet, but I wish I'd have had someone, the sort of people that I kind of have around me now, I wish I had in my 20s to go, this is fine as a decision, but there are alternatives. I was kind of influenced by people in my life who just saw the money and were like, you'd be an idiot not to take that, you know. And by then I was like, I didn't judge any, you know, I was in that world and I thought it's just a difference. It's nipples or no nipples. It's not that much difference to me. Mm. Now with hindsight, I'm like, it is quite a big, you know, that there are certain careers that I would never be able to do because I was a topless model. But, you know, there were also massive benefits. But honestly, it was just, it was just each year going, oh, okay, I'm still employed. Oh, they're probably not going to offer me that money next year to go topless because everyone will just be bored of me by then and hopefully I'll be doing something else. So it was, it was never planned. I wish it was. I wish I could take, like,
credit
for...
It's really interesting, though, because, again, all the things you've learnt there, you've learnt because of the choices you made at the time. And, again, I always remember the first time, like, when I was starting off in music, the first time I got offered a big amount of money for something, and I was living in my bedroom at my mum's house, and I was like, exactly as you'd kind of said that someone had implied to you there, I'd be stupid to turn this down. Yeah. Now, go 3-4 years down the line, I hadn't made millions, but I'd made some money. It was then easy to turn big amounts of money down because I realised it's not all about the money, but it's easy from the outside to be an artist and go, oh, I don't care about the money. But when you're living at home and it's a large amount and you're young, you go, right, well, that makes a difference. But it's then you get to a point where, I've definitely turned down more money than I've made, but that's because I could learn that lesson of going, right, cool, I'm now not, you know, working in HMV anymore or living in my mum's house anymore. I could now go, I've got enough to get by. I don't need all the money. So regardless of how much they're offering, if I don't want to do it, I don't have to do it.
Yeah, and it's such a, and it is, like you said, it's things like that that you can only learn through that lived experience. Yeah. So this is like when me and Beth were talking about, you know, me doing OnlyFans as a joke. And then I started talking to some of the girls and I was like, you're making how much? Literally like, sorry, what? And then I started going, yeah, I could literally have a Hackney townhouse. And you start going, and then I had to kind of, I spoke to my friend who used to be a model, who now is a photographer about it. And I was like, I know that the money isn't everything, because I made so many choices in my 20s for the money, and that money gets spent and those things hang around forever. And it is that thing of, like, back to what we said at the beginning of that, I do think that in your 30s, you know where your joy lies, you know where your happiness lies. And that's not saying, God, if you're the sort of person that just wants to take every opportunity to make as much money as you can, great. But mm-hmm. it is that thing of going, what makes me happy? What am I? You know, I'm far prouder of our little podcast than I am of anything I did when I was modelling. Like it was just a job. And I used to, I mean, it was such a, it's not as simple as this, but whenever they used to kind of have a go at Page Three girls, and I did used to say, you know, no one asks the boy working in Sainsbury's if he's, you know, if he feels exploited or proud of if he's there. He's there for a job. And I used to kind of, you know, traipse that line out all the time. And it's not quite as simple as that, but it was being in an industry where people constantly felt like they had to give an opinion about it was mad. Yeah. You'd meet people and they'd go, oh, what do you do? And oh, I do modelling. And they go, oh, what are they? And people would go, oh, like fashion modelling? And I was like, well, I'm 5'5" with a massive chest, so probably not. And people would feel the need to kind of like panic into going, I think it's fine what you do. And it's kind of like, oh, thanks. I didn't ask for your unsolicited opinion. Yeah. But
I think it's fine that you work in an office. I'm glad we're all comfortable with this.
But me and Beth talk about this, and we really unpicked this. And I was like, but I think the thing there is what I did. I think if you work in media, whether it's music, modelling, making art, making TV, making film, those things do impact on society.
Yeah.
So I think that's why everyone, you know, I used to get really like kind of pissed off by it. But I was like, well, no, actually, like it is a convert. I always remember, God, when I lived in Clapham. Sorry, I'm literally going off here now. I just suddenly remembered this girl. I was walking back from a night out and this really, really drunk girl, I think I'd stopped to get some water. Why did I do that? I was 10 minutes away from home. Anyway, and this girl kind of came up to me while I was buying like a water in the kebab shop. And she went, I think I live next door to you. I still do you. And so she was really drunk. We started chatting and she'd seen me doing a self-tape with my flatmate. And she said, what do you do? Because I saw you filming something the other day. And I said, oh, I'm doing, you know, I was like trying to do a bit of acting. And then I said something about modelling and her face just dropped. And she looked at me and she went, what's your name? And I said, I said, Lucy. And she went, is it Lucy Pinder? I said, yeah. And she just was absolutely like, she just suddenly was like, do you feel really bad about what you do? And I was like, no, not really. And I thought, I thought you're too drunk to be having this conversation, love. Yeah. And she was like, and we got into this, like sat in a kebab shop at like 1 o'clock in the morning of her going, you know, don't you feel bad about the women that have to put up with their boyfriend? And just absolutely went for me. And I was kind of trying to go, well, if you fancy Brad Pitt, I said, do you think your boyfriend's really upset if you want to stick a Brad Pitt, like Legends of the Fall on?
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, well, I think it's totally different. And I remember at the time being a bit, you know, I stayed very calm and was like, oh, okay, that's your, you know, view. But I remember being quite pissed off by it. And then I was like, now I'm a bit older, I'm like, I kind of get why people want to have those conversations, but just mad that you can literally be walking home and someone will just go, right.
What a way to meet your neighbour as well. Not even, this is a stranger, forget it, we're never going to meet again. It's like, oh, this is horrible and I'm going to see you potentially every day.
We could see their kitchen window up in the flat next to ours. And I was like, oh, that's not awkward at all, love.
Yeah,
but now I'm older, I'm not as, I think I was so defensive about it before because I wasn't that at ease with arguing its benefit. So now that I'm older and I've got a bit of distance from it, I'm like, I did that. It wasn't all awful. There was some great stuff to come out of that. I've had some amazing experiences that I would never have had if I didn't do that. But would I choose to do it again? Probably not.
I want to, as you mentioned, self-tapes there, I want to talk a little bit about acting because, again, I found another ridiculous parallel, Lucy. I don't know why this keeps happening, but for me, moving from being a rapper into acting, there's such a hurdle to get past because there's a lot of films that will just put rappers in and they're not necessarily great. They're not necessarily people who are doing it who want to make a career of acting. It's just, oh, I'll be in a film. And it's a similar thing for you. You're going to be wanting to focus on acting and wanting to do good shit, I'd imagine, but still you're Lucy Pinder from FHM or from Nuts or from wherever else. So how have you found that balancing that, I guess, of trying to get taken seriously. If, like, I don't mean that in a bad way, but it is something that you've got to kind of overcome.
Definitely. And I think kind of all I do is kind of hold out thinking that actually age might be on my side here, is that the older I'm getting, because with the acting, like, I'd loved that, you know, I got an A in drama when I was
well, that's it, hearing like that you were going to go off to do film studies and stuff like that. It's clear that that was part of your path. And then
have been obsessed with like film and TV like my whole life. And I did some a few years ago, like I am obsessed with casting, and I did some casting assisting, and I kind of that was what I thought I would end up going in. I was doing some casting assisting for a really fucking great UK casting agency, and I was only meant to be there for 2 weeks, and then she asked me to stay, and I hadn't had an audition for months, and I had to do a self-tape, and I remember just seeing my boss's face when she said, I said something about doing a self-tape, and I think I saw her, as I would as a casting director, I saw her kind of go, oh, you still want to do acting, so you're not taking this seriously. And I ended up getting that role. So it was when I did a little indie film called Me, Myself and Die, and I actually ended up getting the role.
Yeah.
And I think if I hadn't
and one of the lead roles in it as well, not like a small, so that's always the exciting things to get. You get a lot of those auditions in that you're like, it's a line here and there, which is dope. And again, I'm still on that climb, so there's no roles that I feel are below me or too small, but it's always exciting when those ones come through where they're like,
it's
you can get your teeth into it, you know.
Yeah. And just the experience of, like, we shot in Rill for like 3 weeks.
Amazing.
And just like the life experience of that.
Yeah.
If I hadn't have got that, I think I would have just stayed in casting, because I love it, because I'm just obsessed with it. Like, my friend, my flatmate, at the moment, she's a casting assistant, and she's like, you know more people. Like, she'll say something and I'll know actors, because I just consume so much TV and film.
Yeah.
So I think if I hadn't have got Me, Myself and Die, I probably would just have, like, disappeared off into casting by now. But I love acting.
That absolutely fascinates me. Loads of my actor mates mock me, because on the podcast I'll talk about how much I enjoy castings, like going in and auditioning and self-tapes and all of that, and meeting casting directors. And part of it is because I'm not from that world. I've come into this all late. So people have been doing it for years, know that it's a system, it's an industry. Honestly, I've only had one casting in person that I haven't enjoyed. Literally all the others, I'm just like, this is amazing. I had one where, because again, I like the interaction of it and the kind of, I'm very aware that when I walk in the room, a lot of the decision will be made up. I'm 6'4" and I've got a big beard. It's kind of, you'll make a lot of those decisions on impact.
Yeah.
So I just really enjoy the interaction and getting to know them. And as you say, kind of add into their catalogue of people that they might pull up at another time, even if I'm not going to get this kind of thing. But I had one where I'd had the first audition. It was great. I got on great with the casting director, and I got called back to audition in front of the director and producer. And I kind of came in on my usual, like, are you all right, guys? I really like the script, and excited to be all chatty about it. And they're like, okay, if you want to start. It's like, yep, okay. And literally I did it twice and left, and there was no kind of, but that's the only time I've ever had that. Every other casting director, genuinely have had great times just kind of going, let's make something. Like, let's create something.
And I think you learn so much from just doing a casting. Like,
not gone to drama school, that's a workshop, same. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. And I think, I don't know about you, but I have such, like, imposter syndrome about it. And I kind of, there's part of me that's like, I know I can do this. Like, I know that I'm an all right actress with the right direction and the right part, but because I didn't go to drama school, did a bit of training, but you do kind of just go, oh god, like, so I'm, it sounds, it's probably the wrong approach, but I'm just grateful to get a casting, because I think, oh, that's nice, they want to see me. So even if it's not quite, I did one on Monday, and I read the role, and I thought, and because I am obsessed with casting from a casting director's point of view, I thought, I'm not right for this. I wouldn't choose me for this. But I thought, well, I'll tape it. I'll give it a shot, because they might remember me from something else. And I think you just have to... It's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, the casting process, like, it can be when you really want something.
Yeah.
Oh, it can be horrible. I remember...
90% of the time, I'm really good at just doing it and forgetting. But that 10% is brutal.
Yeah.
That 10% when, as you say, it's something you really want that you're like...
Oh, it's literally like... It's like when you're single and you meet someone that you think, oh my God, you'd be perfect for me, but they're married or they've got a partner. Yeah, you're oh no, but that would have been, if that person wasn't around, I'd have been, and that's, I've only probably only had about, in my whole like acting career or of doing castings, I've had three.
Yeah.
And one was when I was really young and before I'd really done anything, I did an in-person audition because it was with my now friend for an Adam Sandler film called Bedtime Stories.
Right, yeah.
And I literally went in and now I'm friends with the casting director. And she said, I remember looking and going, what the fuck are they doing sending Lucy Pinder in? Like, why are they sending me a page three girl?
Yeah.
She's like, this is going to be shit. And I went in, she loved me, and they phoned, this was back when I was just modelling, I didn't have an acting agent, and they phoned my agent, and he phoned me, I remember I was making bolognese in my old house for me and my ex, and he phoned me and he was like, have you got your passport? This is like Tuesday, he was like, they're going to fly you to LA on Thursday, you're going to do a chemistry read with Adam Sandler, they love, like, if that goes well, you're in. And I was like, I think even at the time I thought, I was like, I don't think this is happening. Yeah. And I was a bit like, okay. And my agent was like, right, we need to sort you out an Esther. And I don't think I'd even ever been to America then. And then literally, so this was the evening because I was cooking. And by 10 a.m. the next morning, they were like, oh, they've gone with someone else. So I learned really early
heartbreaking, on. Heartbreaking, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's really mad because I think they went with, is it Teresa Palmer? It's ingrained in my brain that this role was meant to be like, it was like British spoil aristocrat. Think like Kim Kardashian, but British and blah, blah, blah. And they gave it to Teresa Palmer. It was such a lesson in me going, oh, the brief means nothing. So it was a really good lesson and it was good because it made me think, oh, I can do this. Like if I got that close to that, but there have been a couple of those that I still go, oh, I wonder what would have happened if I got that. But you just don't know. You have to just let it go, don't you?
On one of the early episodes of the podcast, I had Ed Skrein on, who's a mate,
who was
amazing actor and great guy. And he said his kind of his motto on that. And it's just simply, why the fuck not?
Yeah.
And just based on the fact that he looks at every role and goes, well, someone has to play that. So why not me?
Yeah.
And it changed my approach as well, because I was exactly the same on looking, thinking, I'm never going to get this. And then you go, well, actually, there's loads of films I watch that has got huge people in, but they'll, even as a film nerd, there'll be an actor in there that I'm not that familiar with.
Yeah.
That could be me. You know, I may not be at the huge level, but that's how it works. Someone
Absolutely.
Has to do all of this.
Absolutely. And I do think from doing a bit of casting assisting, it's helped. It's made me see how brutal it can be because I've been sat in a room where it's, I've clipped someone's self-tape and the casting director's gone, no. And I'm literally like, but she hasn't spoken yet. And they're like, no. And I'm like, oh my God, they've spent all day. But on the flip side, I found that really helpful because I was like, if you're not right, you're not right.
Yeah.
And it is like, it's like the chemistry thing of meeting people. You kind of go, God, the odds are really against me. But also, like you said, someone's got to get it.
Yeah.
So why not? And I'm like you. Completely. I love being on set. Like I joke to my agent because he's, you know, he'll say, oh, no, we want to get you this and that. And I'm like, who am I to come in and demand? Like, I would do anything. I just quite like being on sets. Like, I'm happy to be like wench number three in the background at the bar because I just, I love that industry.
The amount of times I've had to say to my agent, like, you do your thing, but be aware I'm doing this role. So if you demand all this crazy stuff and they say no, I'll hit them up and do it for free because I'm doing this. It's like, obviously I know it's their job to kind of, as we were talking about earlier, protect your value, protect your worth. If you've got to a certain, I always remember that from touring days, that our live agent would be like, well, no, once we've started putting you out for this much money, we can't put you out for that much money, because it means everyone should then have to pay that. And I mean, I understand there's business sides of things, but with everything in acting, it's like every time there's a role that I really want and they've offered, and it's now the negotiation bit, I'm like, look,
just give
just
it
don't
to
mess
me.
It up, basically, because it's going to go wrong.
Oh, I know. I'm literally like, it's like with modelling when we used to, you know, there are some jobs that you do for the money, and there are some that you go, I really want to do that, so I would take less. And I do think it's such a, and I've got so many friends who are actors, and it's fucking hard. Like, and I've got friends that trained and have worked really hard, and it's hard, isn't it? Because it's, you feel like it's such a privilege to be working, but also I do think in the creative arts, like, people can get, like, especially if you really want something, and that shouldn't mean that people can pay you less, because you're still work, like, it's a fine balance, isn't it?
Exactly that. And that's why, and again, agents, it's why agents and that are so amazing and important, because they're the ones who have to keep that balance, because
because we can blame it all on them.
Us fucking nerds who just want to go and be part of it and being, I just want to be in the canteen and hang out with everyone.
I was about to say, I just want to be in the canteen.
So again, if it was down to us, we'd be getting paid nothing and we'd be working crazy hours. So that's why they're absolute heroes. I mean, we could talk for hours, but I've got to wrap this up. So I guess what's the plan going forward? Is acting the focus, acting and the podcast? I know you're recording new episodes. In fact, have you been recording new episodes already?
We did the first ep on Saturday with Dan Thomas, who's a Welsh comedian. Amazing. Me and Beth are. We were so hungover. So it's very Smashing Sundays. It's very Smashing Sundays. So we're recording a load in a couple of weeks. Yeah, we're just keeping on, you know, keeping on trucking on, auditioning. I love acting. I love doing the podcast. Me and Beth are kind of, there's a couple of projects that we want to do. There's one which is basically just like a vanity project that we want to try and get. So my bugbear is that loads of male, I know, like, I'm not really a celebrity. Me and Beth are like, we're not famous enough, but loads of like male celebrities get paid loads of money just to go around traveling with like their mum or their best mate. And I'm like, I want us to do that. I think we should go around, so that we've got like a TV show. And then I started writing an autobiography and I'm just not candid enough. When I started writing it, I thought, I can't release this anytime soon, because so much of my kind of pivotal life moments, other people are so involved that I just think, I don't think I would feel comfortable releasing a book yet. So I'm trying to, me and my old manager actually have talked about this quite a lot, about doing either a book or a script that's like loosely based on me.
All of my music was always, because I felt exactly the same. I wanted to write really personal and open and honest stuff, but I didn't feel comfortable. So every song I wrote, except for one, was kind of based on true emotions and feelings, but changed the events or the people or things like that. And always made it me. So I was always like, as if I've gone through all this. And I think that I completely understand that weirdness of, it's going to be shit if you hold back. But equally, if it's other people's stories or other people's trust, even if it's your story, but it was trusted amongst someone, then it's a tough one. As that makes
a
lot of sense to try and create something
new. Going, oh, it's a script. It's not me. Oh no, that person you think you recognise from that funny story. No, I can't. So that, I think I really need to. I'm so bad. I'm such a procrastinator. I get easily put off. I get imposter syndrome, and this year I'm like, no, the podcast, we just want to build, like, not like build a brand, but we just want to build on it because we love doing it so much. So if we can just do, we want to do more of that and just write and make some stuff for telly, hopefully. And hopefully someone will give me an acting job. Hopefully I'll be like a dead body in Father Brown soon or something.
I love it. Well, I can't wait for that episode, and I can't wait for the new episodes of Smashing Sundays. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming in and chatting.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Lucy Pinder. I was really excited to have Lucy on because I think she's one of many examples that kind of smashed the stereotype, the unfair stereotype that was built in that Lads Mag era of, as she mentioned, the kind of poorly used quotes or just completely fictional quotes that gave the impression of the whole, yeah, that 90s, early 2000s bimbo cliche. So many of the women I know from that era are wonderfully articulate and intelligent and, you know, far more than simply what was maybe presented for the consumption of late 90s, early 2000s lads. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And there's more chat coming next week. I have an amazing chat with Beth Granville. Really, as I say at the start of it, I didn't know loads and loads about her outside of the podcast and a radio show she did. So I didn't know how it'd go. I didn't know if it'd be a shorter episode or awkward conversations. And man, it was one of the easiest conversations I've had. I know I bring that up a lot if it happens, but I always think that's a really positive thing when you meet someone for the first time and it's just a really easy chat. And that was the case with Lucy. We chatted for about 30 minutes after this because, as a lot of you listeners will know, I'm a I'm a big fan of casting directors and the casting process, and I didn't know that Lucy had worked in that world as well, and I find that shit fascinating. So, yeah, we got into a load of stuff off mic as well. Yeah, so I'll be back on Friday with another wonderful guest. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.